John, tell me, if you can, what Rose thought about you being set to go to Vietnam and actually being there.
Yeah, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
Yeah, she wasn't any more excited about it than I was, and particularly with her situation, because now we have 7 kids, and so she's going to be solo. The good news about that, though, was it wasn't as dramatic a transformation for her as it might have been for someone else that maybe had had a staff job or something that was home every night. Because with all the alert that I had been pulling, I mean, I was gone a week at a time, even though I was actually right in the area on the base, but still away from home for a week at a time, usually every second or third week. So to that extent, it kind of conditioned her for my being gone for the year. But still in all, that's a pretty heavy load to carry.
Where was she living?
Well, we were living on base at Grissom, and she was allowed to stay on base while I went to 130 school.
Okay.
But then she had to move off when I finished school and went to Vietnam, and she moved her to a little town about 8 miles from Boswell, this town that I had visited, where my mother had moved after my father died. She moved to this town of Fowler, Indiana, which is quite a bit larger than the little town of Boswell was.
So Fowler is where she was?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we found a house to rent there for a year, and that's where she stayed. The thinking there that she had my mother.
Sure.
And some relatives around there to kind of help her out. So.
Yeah, and your mom had her, too, and the kids. So.
Yeah.
And the kids' ages at this time?
Let's see, we're talking 70, so Susie was born in 57, so she's 13, that's the oldest.
And then on down from there.
And Stephanie was 68, so she was November 68, so she was just a little over a year.
Wow.
She was about a year and a half, so from 13 to a year and a half.
And they weren't going to see their dad for a year.
Yeah.
That's rugged.
Yeah.
That's tough. Tough for you, too, of course, but boy, oh, boy.
I think toughest, though, for the mom.
Oh, my God. Rose. Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Really, really, really a tough story for her.
She's some gal,
yeah.
I'm sure.
And then, as luck would have it, I forget what it was they came down with, but she and most of the kids had this kind of coughing thing or something that was really pretty bad, and she was having to drive back and forth to Grissom from this town, which was about 60 miles, to go to the hospital all the time with those kids, so that further exacerbated the situation, and that was early after I left, right after I left that she was having all those problems. And then they diagnosed our oldest son as having that they thought he was going to need heart surgery, which she never told me about. And as it turned out, when they took a closer look, they decided he didn't need it. But those were some of the things she was having to deal with.
That's just, I mean, incredible.
Yeah.
And she, of course, she made the strategic decision not to worry you with what she would have to handle.
Yeah,
Wow. That's incredible. I just cannot imagine.
She's quite a girl.
I guess so. Good choice.
Yeah.
Good choicing skills.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, John, let me talk to you a little bit about Tonsonut. First of all, what were your quarters like? Where were you? Were you actually staying on base?
Yeah.
Okay.
We were in a as I recall, it was a two-story barracks-type building. The thing I remember about it was it had fantastic air conditioning. Man, you'd walk in that building and it was like cold because it was so hot there in Saigon, particularly in the summertime.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But the thing I remember, it's funny the things you remember. Two things that I remember vividly was when you'd walk out of that building outside, and if you had your sunglasses on, they'd immediately fog up and because of the high humidity that you had around there and the temperature change, and you'd be IFR with your sunglasses on. The other thing was, I can't remember ever on Tonsonut outside a building not hearing helicopters. They had a big maintenance depot there, just a couple of blocks from the officers club and our barracks where we lived, and it was just 24/7. I mean, the helicopters, you just heard them all the time.
Wow.
Those are the things I remember about Tonsonut.
The guys that you flew with, were they all essentially on one-year in-country rotations, too?
Yes.
So you didn't have the stability?
No, and
you?
Also you didn't have the crew integrity like SAC.
Right, exactly.
Here it was just whoever was available to go in-country is who you went with.
Gosh, and so would you be flying with different people every week, every couple
weeks? Yeah, well, every couple weeks. What the way it would work, Laura, and I'm trying, you know, now I can't remember. I want to say maybe it was about 2 or 3 weeks. I think when we'd go in, about 3 weeks, I think we'd go in. When we'd fly, we'd fly out of Taiwan, fly into Tonsonut, and then we'd be there for 3 weeks flying sorties for 3 weeks. Then we'd go back to Taiwan, usually be back maybe a week, and then turn around and go back into Tonsonut again. For about every fourth trip, instead of going to Tonsonut, we'd go to Utapau, Thailand, and fly the Klong Hopper, which were just kind of like a Southwest Airlines type operation. We flew the same route every day to all the bases in Thailand. We were the local air carrier for passengers between all the bases in Taiwan and in Thailand.
So you got to see the bases, probably, and not much else in Thailand.
That's it.
Is that fair?
We were only on the ground long enough to offload and onload the people.
But you were based out of
Utapau.
And what were the accommodations like there?
I that's a good question. I can't remember.
Is that
I know what I lived in when I was there in B-52s a year later.
Right.
In trailers, but I don't know if we stayed in barracks when I was over there in doing the trash hauling thing. Probably we did. I really don't remember. I would assume we were in the barracks then. I know we were on base, although some of the guys lived off base, but that was SAC. That was when I was over there with the B-52s.
Yeah.
But with the 130, with the flying the Klong Hopper, we must have been in the barracks.
Now, did everybody call it, is it the Klong Hopper? Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, that's what we called it when we were flying this this route in where we went to all the bases, kind of like I say, like a Southwest, not Southwest Airlines. It would be like, what's one of the feeders for American? Whatever the little feeder lines are.
Right.
That's really what we were. We just flew, like I say, you had the same schedule every day. You'd take off from Utapau, you'd go to Don Muang, which was the airport at, in Bangkok, and then you flew around to all the bases, and that was your daily trip. And the reason they called it the Klong Hopper was, of course, all the klongs over there in Thailand, the water. Somebody just came up with that name, Klong Hopper.
And it stuck.
And it stuck, yeah. That's what they referred to. And it's interesting because it was a Klong Hopper when you were flying that mission in Thailand, but then when you got back in Vietnam, then you were just a regular trash hauler.
Right. Well, did you feel a difference when you were flying in Thailand than when you did when you were flying around South Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
I'll bet you did.
Totally different. Totally different. In Thailand, like I say, you were just that. Then you had the feeling of what it must be like to be flying for the airlines, because that's essentially what we were doing. We were just flying like an airline around there, hauling passengers. And in Vietnam, we hauled everything. I mean, the old adage we had is you call, we haul, and that was about it. I mean, you hauled all kinds of materials. You called people. You hauled Vietnamese civilians that were being relocated. You just hauled, carried everything, and you were operating out of all different types of fields, whereas in Thailand, flying into the bases, you always had a big runway and support and everything else. So, yeah, they were totally different missions.
In South Vietnam, can you remember the names of some of or one of the worst fields you had to negotiate?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly. The two worst fields I operated out of, by worst I mean no support, and they were dirt, were Budop and Jamop. And I don't know how to spell those.
That's
but
okay.
I know where they were.
Where?
At the Parrot's Peak in Cambodia, because what we were doing were inserting troops into Cambodia. We were landing right next to the Cambodian border and inserting troops. And those fields were really, really challenging.
You know, I should clarify what month you actually got over there. So
got there in May of 70.
Okay, so that's the incursion is happening.
Yeah.
The U.S. incursion.
When was that incursion? I think it was...
started April 29th, I think.
Did it? Yeah, okay. So that sounds about right, because that I know those were some of the earliest missions I flew over there, was into Budop and Jamop. And I was flying those right after I got over there. So that checks.
And those were U.S. and ARVN troops, or just U.S.?
I think, as I recall, just U.S. I don't remember carrying any ARVNs in there.
Okay. And those fields were bad because they were dirt. There was nothing there, probably.
Yeah, and they were short.
Wow.
I forget how long they were, but they were challenging to get the airplane on the ground and then taking off too. And I've got a war story for you on that, Laura.
All right, here we go.
You ready?
Yes, absolutely.
Boy, this was a lesson learned, and it really, really had an impact on me. And it has to do with how war affects people.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of reminds me of a movie. What was that movie? Full Metal Jack? No, it wasn't that. What was the one that Charlie Sheen was in where the opening scene, I digress here, but
that's
just
okay.
Bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
The opening scene of this movie is Charlie Sheen kind of not knowing what to do with his life. He's out of high school, and he gets caught up in the excitement of going to Vietnam and being where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's all pumped. And they show this scene, the opening scene, when he lands at Cam Ranh Bay,
right.
And they're taxiing in, and they've got about 20 body bags out on the runway that they're about to load on another airplane as they're parking his.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch his face when he looks out there and sees those body bags and realizes what they are, and you can just see what's going through his mind, like he's thinking, I wonder if this was a real good idea I had to come over here and be where the action's at.
Yeah, the action's pretty...
I think for the first time, what I got from that scene
mm-hmm.
was now he realizes this isn't John Wayne in Hollywood. This is the real deal. And you can die in this environment. Real easy, you can die. And I just kind of got the feeling this is the first time he really realized just...
what the stakes are.
How big this deal is.
Yeah.
And now, back to my story. Same thing, really. I can remember vividly carrying these guys in, and they're all, you know, they're pumped up. They're John Wayne-ing it and everything else as they go in. And then we'd extract them
right.
A few weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
These guys look 30 years older and just like they had aged 30 years in 3 weeks. Just amazing the difference in the demeanor of these guys when you carried them in for the first time and then when you brought them out. I don't know what they ran into in those 3 weeks, but it must have been life-changing. I couldn't believe the difference in them.
Were they quiet, John, when they would get back on the plane?
You better believe they were. Yeah. And so many of them had that 1,000-yard stare.
And when you think of that, is there anything you can say about how that felt for you to be, you know, seeing that yourself
yeah.
as well?
Yeah, it just made me think again of what I've always said about whoever the famous person was that made that short observation, war is hell. Oh, I think it was in the Civil War, wasn't it?
I don't know, but it sticks. It works.
Yeah, war is hell, and I think it was. I think it might have been Sherman. I don't know who it was, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that always crossed my mind is, you know, I think supposedly we are the most intelligent species on this planet,
mm-hmm.
but why is it that this is the way we settle our differences? You know, we have to kill each other. You'd think that we would be progressed to a point where we wouldn't have to do this, but... it looks like it's hardwired into our genetics that's the way we solve our differences, and it's just so frustrating to me that's what we have to go through to do it, and particularly it's one thing with somebody like me, who I kind of look at as a professional soldier. You know, I chose that as a life. But what about these kids? You know, these guys that we were inserting, 18, 19 years old, they don't have a clue what's going on, and they're dying, you know, and it's just a very, very sad, sobering experience for me. It was then, it always has been, and it's just something that makes me very sad.
John, did you have to also bring body bags out?
I don't recall. It seems to me we might have carried some body bags a couple of times, but if we did, it was very seldom, very seldom.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, you're right. It is a good thing.
Yeah, it was better to carry those guys, whatever they've been through, out of there.
Yeah, to bring them
alive.
Alive, yeah.
Would you take them specifically back to Saigon, or would you drop them off somewhere else?
No, we'd always bring them back to Saigon.
Oh, okay.
And then
okay.
I don't know what, you know, from there.
Wow. And I bet they were never so happy to get on a plane.
Yeah, I'm sure they were like we were up in Hanoi.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a similar feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here. Let's go.
Yeah.
Were there times ever, either going up to the Cambodian border or elsewhere, that you either saw enemy personnel, or did you take fire at any point?
Used to take some fire, small arms fire, but very seldom.
Did you even know that you were taking small arms fire?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, in a C-130, you would know that.
Yeah, we did a couple of times. Funny, the most we took was going into, gee whiz, I'm trying to remember the name of that base now. It was real close to Tonsonut. Big base.
Benoit.
That was it.
Yeah.
Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was early in the morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and all at once Tower, we're on final approach, and Tower says, be advised, Benoit is closing down. Enemy fire off the end of the runway. We look down there, and here are these tracers coming up right at us.
Wow.
And but really, enemy action was very limited. We didn't see much in the 130 operation. I didn't see much. In fact, after I was an instructor and started taking guys in for their in-country checkout, of course, they were all concerned about getting shot down or about enemy fire.
Mm-hmm.
I told them all, I said, that is the least of your worries. I said, if you buy it over here, the way you're going to buy it is either on a landing or takeoff, or more likely is a midair with a friendly. You're going to fly into some friendly airplane before you get hit or shot down.
Now, John, did you talk about those, about the potential for midairs because of how much traffic there was, or because control?
Just strictly a numbers thing, number of aircraft in the air. And when it was really scary was when you'd have a low ceiling.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to stay VFR. And so now you've got the airspace is compressed because everybody's trying to stay VFR, mm-hmm. so they're all trying to stay under the clouds. And you've got so many airplanes. It was really something to see.
Was Tonsonut the worst, or...
Usually you get around Tonsonut, Da Nang, Benoit, Cameron Bay, the big airfields. That's where most of the traffic was.
Yeah. Did you fly up into the highlands at all?
Yep. Did a few times.
What was your impression?
What's the name of that?
Dalat? Yeah. Dalat is one place.
Yeah.
Did you ever get off and walk around at Dalat or Kontum or any of those places?
Yeah, we usually did there because a lot of times we'd be on the ground for a couple hours.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, they're offloading and getting another, if we had something to carry out or when they were loading the airplane. So a lot of times, but we never got off the field. We never got off the airfield. So I never got into the local area around it.
And was that primarily because of safety issues?
And
also, I guess you're on duty, so you're not going to...
Yeah, well, it was primarily safety. But the other thing was that you never knew when they were going to finish loading, so you didn't want the crew strung out all over the place and what was waiting. Because I'll tell you one thing over there, Laura. These people did not like... Now, it was okay at the big bases, but when you got out into the smaller airfields around there, they did not want you on the ground 1 minute longer than they absolutely had to have you there because we were referred to as mortar magnets. We were the mortar magnets.
The C-130s.
Yeah, for sure. Man, if there was somebody out there with a mortar, that's what they wanted to get was a 130.
Did your aircraft, while sitting on the ground, ever draw a mortar round?
What about
guys that you were talking to at Tonsonut?
I don't remember. You know, I was there 70 and 71. The ones that really had some hairy stories were the 67, 68
right,
guys.
Right, yeah.
But most of them were gone. There were a few that had been there 67, 68, gone back to the States for a year and then rotated back over.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were gone. But the few that were there, they had some real war stories about being under fire and mortars and everything else in the 67, 68 time frame. But really, I can't remember anybody. There might have been a couple. I think there were. I think there were a couple that talked about getting caught when they were out somewhere and taking some mortar rounds. But that was rather limited.
John, as you were moving all over South Vietnam, certainly Central and Northern Vietnam, did you have an impression? Were you kind of feeling sort of like an observer too of the war and kind of how it was going? Did you think about those things? You know, is the U.S. here operationally?
You know, I don't
playing the right plan, or
I don't think I did. I don't think I really thought about it that much. Because we were just so busy flying our sorties every day and dropping off the stuff. So I never really did think much big picture as much as I did a year later when I was over there back there in B-52s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started thinking about the strategy that was being utilized, that was being employed and things like that, and started wondering about what is this deal. I really did a lot more of that type thinking with the B-52 than I did with the 130.
Well, I'll make a note that, I'll come back and ask you about that.
Okay.
Were you at any time interacting with South Vietnamese personnel, military or otherwise?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Did you have any interaction with our allies who were drawing down their forces at the same time we were,
In a detached way, I did with the South Koreans. I had an additional duty one time to, and I can't even remember what they called me, but they had a parachute drop zone that was about, maybe 20, 30 clicks out of Saigon, and that's just what it was. They used to have their guys practice jumping. And the Arvin were primarily the ones, some of our guys, and the South Koreans. And I remember specifically the Koreans. They were a pretty impressive group. They always seemed to be more military than any other country.
Mm-hmm.
And one war story about that, and this was my 130 tour. There was a resort area on the south coast, south of Saigon, called Vung Tau.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
And Highway 1, it ran from Saigon to Vung Tau.
Mm-hmm.
There was some risk involved in going, kind of like the highway from, well, not as bad as the highway from Baghdad to the airport, but kind of along that same line, that snipers used to like to pick off a few people on that highway, Vung Tau.
Sort of a gauntlet.
Yeah. But people caught on real quickly that there was a certain time when you wanted, if you were going to go to Vung Tau, there was a certain time you wanted to go. And that's when South Korea had responsibility for security on the highway.
No kidding.
Because nobody, you were, it was like being back in the States when South Korea had, when they were responsible for security. You were safe then.
Do you know what that was based on, or can you say what it was based on?
All I can do is guess.
Uh-huh.
And I think that probably what South Koreans did was shoot first and ask questions later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the word got out to the VC that we don't want to be taking the chance when they're, because they'll kill you before they're not going to ask any questions or check you out. They'll just flat kill you. And that's my guess.
Mm-hmm. And the VC would presumably dial it down a little
I think they decided maybe we better lay low while they're while they have security.
Now, did you go down and hang it at Vung Tau at all?
No, I didn't. I flew in there a few times, but no, I never did drive down.
That was pretty much an Australian area, was it?
Yeah, Did
you ever get off the
field? But again, if I did, it was just on the ramp. I really didn't go into the town or anything.
Okay. So, essentially, you were at the barracks on Tansanut flying away and then flying back.
Yeah, we'd fly a sortie.
Yeah.
And you would fly usually 8 or 9 hours.
Wow.
And you flew your frag, and that was it. You always took off and landed, except for one time.
Uh-huh.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, one time. We go down to fly, walk in there, and they say, hey, the scheduler says, got a different frag for you today.
Now, by frag?
Whatever they had mapped out for you to do. Like, a frag would be, okay, you're going to go to, you're carrying cargo to Vung Tau, you're carrying cargo to Vung Tau, they're going to load some stuff on there. From there, you'll go to Loc Ben. From Loc Ben, you'll go to someplace, and they'll say, and they'd tell you what you were going to be carrying, from where to where. They had your whole frag laid out. I don't know why they called it frag, but anyway, that was your mission plan for that day.
Right.
What you were going to do.
Uh-huh.
And this day, they just said, "We've got a special mission for you today. you're going to fly empty to Cameron, and there'll be some people there to meet you when you land, and they'll brief you on what your frag's going to be for the day." Well, that was unusual, because you always got it right there at Saigon, at Tansanut, and you went and flew your frag, and then you came back and landed.
Right.
So we go to Cameron. Sure enough, we park, and when they're parking us on the ramp, here comes this vehicle, and they say, okay, come with us. We'll load the airplane while we brief you on what you're going to be doing. So we go in and brief, and they said, you're going to be going to Jakarta. And but the deal is, your cargo is something that you are not to mess with. And they're primarily talking to our loadmaster.
Right.
Here's the deal: you will not mess with the load on that airplane. And to me, they said the only way you get rid of that load is if you're going to lose the airplane. If you think by dropping the load you can save the airplane, then and only then will you jettison the load. Other than that, you don't. And you do not get nosy, loadmaster, or any other crew member, trying to see what this load is.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that's kind of interesting.
It almost makes you want to look.
And Jakarta. Where in the hell is Jakarta?
Yeah.
Because we'd never been out of country, and here we are going to Indonesia.
Exactly.
And then it gets more interesting. They said, now here's the deal. They said, your flight plan shows that you're going to Manila. And so when you get out, when you're west of Manila on the way to Jakarta, they're probably going to be calling you wanting to know, why are you continuing southbound when you're supposed to be going into Manila? And you don't answer the radio. We have people in Manila Airways that know what your mission is, and they'll handle it. And I'm thinking to myself, easy for you to say.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, how do I know that?
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, that's the brief. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. We get out there, and they're calling us, and we just don't answer them. And I guess they had everything taken care of, like they told us, because we didn't get jumped by fighters or anything, or we didn't get shot down. So we go in, we land at Jakarta, and interesting, on approach, my co-pilot says, hey, those look like MiGs there, which they were.
Wow.
And MiGs on the runway. That was interesting. Landing in an airport with MiGs.
How many did you see?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10. And that was interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, we land, and we get the same drill. They're there to meet us. And they say, okay, we're going to be offloading this, and we're going to put a load on for you to carry back. And in the meantime, we'll take you on a tour of Jakarta, and we'll give you your briefing for the flight back to Cameron. So we do. And we go back to the airplane, and we get back in the airplane. We look back in the cargo area, and it looks like the plane's empty. But when you look closer, you see these wooden boxes on the floor of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Then we look at the Form F, and they show that the airplane is fully loaded, that we're max gross weight. And we're looking at that and said, something is wrong here. And, in fact, I let the co-pilot make takeoff, and I said, I'd expect this airplane to come off the runway much sooner than what we've mission planned it at.
Right.
Because I don't think his airplane's at max gross weight. Well, the airplane was at max gross weight. So my assumption is, and the crew kind of agreed with me, I think we carried AK-47s or some type of weapons into Jakarta, and what we brought out was gold, because I can't think of anything else that would be that heavy and not take up any more space than it did in that cargo compartment.
And that they could just put in a wooden box with no protection or anything.
Yeah, so...
Well, that's a little weird.
Yeah, that was weird.
And you flew back into Cameron Bay?
Back into Cameron, same thing. They offloaded the airplane, and then we flew back to Tanzanute, and that was our sortie for that day.
That's very odd.
Yeah, that was the only off-the-wall mission I had while I was over there.
Any idea when in your year that happened? Was it still in 1970?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. It could have been 70 or 71. I really don't remember when it was.
That's a strange,
yeah, that
strange
was a,
thing.
But I could tell because I still have the manifest, although it's written in either Indonesian or something. But I have the manifest from that load we carried down there. You know, what I ought to do is get somebody that might be able to break that out, and maybe they can. Maybe it says what it was, but I doubt it. I'll bet whatever they had on that manifest wasn't really what the cargo was, or they had it listed as something else.
Sure, would be interesting to
get that translated. Yeah, I never even thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I need to do that.
Yeah, we could help you with that.
Oh, okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Was there a scariest flight of this tour with those C-130s?
Probably, and this is just off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but it might have been taking Arvin up to Quang Tri for Lamson 714 or something like that.
Yep,
was it?
Lamson 719.
719?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been at the end of the year of 70. That was December and January of 70, 71.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason I remember is my co-pilot at that time was a UT kid. And I'm a big Notre Dame fan.
Right.
And it was the year that Texas and Notre Dame played in the Cotton Bowl.
Oh, really?
And we were listening to it on HF radio.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what, and I remember the weather. The weather was just terrible. It was like it was when I was in Hanoi, just total overcast every day. And we were carrying all these Arvin from Saigon up to Quang Tri, and it was such a big operation that we had airplanes stacked up every 1,000 feet from about 5,000 up to 20,000 feet in the holding pattern, waiting to come down and land and offload your troops. And in that weather, holding and knowing that there's an airplane 1,000 feet above you, 1,000 feet below you, and hoping they're on their altitude,
mm-hmm.
That was probably about the hairiest thing.
That sounds a little itchy.
Yeah.
And you, any idea how long you had to circle there until you could get down?
I would say probably, usually in the holding pattern, you're usually there about 20, 25 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is just walk you down. Every time a guy would make an approach and land, then they'd walk everybody 1,000 feet lower. And so you were constantly descending another 1,000 feet. And
do you know what airstrip you were going into? Was it Quang Tri City?
Yeah, we knew we were going in. Well, I don't know. Whatever. Do they have more than one strip at palm tree? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't
probably
think so
not.
Either. We knew we were going to Quan Tree.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense of what the operation was, or were you just briefed on you're going from here to here with this?
The only sense I had, we weren't briefed on what the operation was. You know, the only thing they ever briefed us on, just like the Jakarta thing,
sure,
was here's your frag. You're taking this. You're taking that. Here's where you go, and that's all. And you don't have a need to know why or anything else. But I just assumed from the size of the operation that there were that many 130s carrying that many Arvin up there that whatever it was big that they were going about. But that was about all I knew.
Wow. John, did you have any R&R time off during this year?
Yes, I did. And the R&R that I remember most was when Rose and... Remember my DSO and B-58s?
You mean Larry?
Larry?
Mm-hmm.
Larry and I both ended up in that same 130 outfit.
No kidding.
And so it just so happened that his wife and my wife got together and flew to Bangkok.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
In December of 70. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they came over in December of 70. And so we spent... a few days with our wives in Bangkok and down at Pattaya Beach,
mm-hmm.
and had a good time there visiting with them. So that was R&R. And then the one other R&R I had was about midway through my tour.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to take a 130 from Taiwan back to Marietta, Georgia, for modification.
At the Lockheed plant.
Mm-hmm. That was so I got to spend a few days at home on that.
Now, did Rose come down to see you?
No. You ready for another war story?
Absolutely.
I brought a ton of Taiwanese furniture back from... The scheduler was a real good friend of mine, and periodically we'd get these... we'd have these airplanes scheduled to go back to Marietta for maintenance. And,
right.
And that was a highly sought-after trip, of course.
I'll bet,
and,
yeah.
So he... set me up for this thing, but although I was scheduled for it from the time I got there, and this was 6 months down the road, there were things that could happen, like if the airplane was still needed in country, or if the airplane broke, or something like that, that would preclude your taking it back. So it wasn't a guaranteed thing, but it usually went. So I bet a lot of money on the fact that I was going to get that trip because I had all this furniture built over there.
You had it built?
Yeah.
You arranged for it?
Go to the furniture company, you know, and say, hey, well, I say built. That's not really true because a lot of the stuff, like the bedroom set and everything, was just go in their showroom and look at what they've got and bought it. But
right.
But when I say built, I built a stereo cabinet, built it around the components I had at that time, a reel-to-reel tape player and all this different stuff, a phonograph.
Mm-hmm.
Table and all this stuff. But anyway,
right.
I'm getting all this stuff. And, of course, to ship it back was going to be pretty expensive. So I decided, I know what I'll do. I'll just carry it back on this 130 and back to Grissom and where Rose was living in Fowler. When I finally decided to do this, I said, okay, Rose, here's the deal. I said, you get my little brother, get a U-Haul trailer, and come to... Grissom, come to base operations. We'll meet at about 4 o'clock in the morning because I know how security is at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so I landed at Grissom Air Force Base at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Rose and my little brother were there with the car with the U-Haul on it. Drove it out on the flight line, offloaded all that furniture onto that U-Haul trailer. And Rose and my little brother went back to Fowler with the furniture. And I flew on to Marietta to drop the airplane off.
Oh, my God.
And then I flew back up to Indianapolis and spent a few days at home and then went back to Vietnam.
So she did get to actually see you for a little bit.
Right,
Not just with the U-Haul and all.
Yeah, in fact, she got to see me twice. I took the airplane back and then when she went over to Bangkok that December.
Okay, and so that the Bangkok trip followed... This,
right.
The furniture run.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, did you do well out of the furniture thing? Do you still have any of it?
Did we still have it all.
Oh.
Yeah, that worked out beautifully. The other big thing was, the other part of that story was,
mm-hmm.
Up until about 3 months before I took the airplane back, the other people that were taking these airplanes back, they were doing the same thing. They were taking furniture and stuff back. And usually when you'd go through customs at Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
you just, all you had to do was list the items on your customs declaration. And they'd say, okay, and you just went your way. They didn't make you bring it in because it was furniture off the airplane. But they had started tightening up their procedures. And they were saying, anything you declare, you have to bring into the building.
Uh-huh.
And so essentially what they were saying is, good luck. You know, you're going to have to make a decision.
Yeah, declare or not declare.
Declare or not declare.
Uh-huh.
I was still thinking about this about an hour out of Hawaii, and finally decided I better declare it, because if they decide to inspect the airplane and I haven't declared it, then I'm in a lot of trouble.
Right.
And I thought, maybe I can silver tongue them. And so I declare it and go in there, and of course, where's this stuff at? It's out on my airplane. You have to bring it in. Get serious. How am I going to bring in all this stuff? That's your problem. You're going to have to do it. And anyway, after quite a conversation, I finally get this customs guy to agree that he will have the customs guy at McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento, which is where we were going to fly to from
mm-hmm.
Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
that he will meet our airplane and he will inspect the cargo.
In other words, he'll come out to the aircraft.
Yeah, he'll come out to the aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, okay, fine. And so I said, okay, guys, we're going to land at McClellan at 4 o'clock in the morning using my same strategy, which worked. I mean, we land, there's nobody around anywhere. So that's the way I got through customs. And then from McClellan, we went to Grissom, and from Grissom to Marietta.
That was quite a deal.
Yeah.
And you still got the furniture, so.
Yeah, got the furniture offloaded, got it, and we still have it. And so that worked out very well, as
sure
it turns
did.
Out.
Sure did. Well, as you were coming closer to your the end of your 1 year in Vietnam, did you have a sense of what your next posting would be? Or did you just, not care, get me out of here?
No. I knew that I was going to be going back to SAC.
Okay.
All of us were. We were just kind of, it was kind of a deal where the command just loaned you to the Southeast Asia Command while you were there, and then everybody knew they were going back. So I knew I was going back in SAC, and so really what I was interested in was base of choice. And I was kind of between Barksdale and Carswell. Barksdale, because a lot of the guys that were over there in G models were flying out of Barksdale. Most of them seemed to like Shreveport. And Carswell, of course, Dallas-Fort Worth, but that wing that I was in at Altus had been an old B-36 wing, and all of them had been stationed at Carswell. All I ever heard people talk about was Fort Worth this, Fort Worth that, how great Fort Worth was. And
mm-hmm.
so here was an opportunity to see how good Fort Worth was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I ended up back in B-52s at Carswell.
And were you thinking at that time about where you might want to be after your 20 years? I mean, is that why you
no.
were interested in Fort Worth or not?
No, really
okay.
hadn't. Really hadn't
okay.
given that much thought.
But basically, the rep for Carswell was that it was a good base.
Yeah.
Because Fort Worth.
Yeah, if you're
going
to be in SAC and have to go back to B-52s, Carswell would probably be a pretty good base of choice.
And you were lucky enough then to get that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that was 71 to 72?
Correct.
And you were, can you just outline the mission of the B-52s that you were flying? These are back in
yeah,
SAC.
Yeah, it was exactly like, it was the identical mission to what it was at Altus when I was there from 60 to 66, and the same mission in the B-58 when I was at Grissom, and that's pulling alert, flying training missions, that type thing.
Mm-hmm. Were you thinking? I'm sorry, John.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask whether you were thinking that you'd done your year in Vietnam and now you weren't going to have to do that again.
Yeah. Okay. And I thought, well, at least, you know, I'm through with the Vietnam thing and I've just got to go to a 20 now and that'll be it. And then I go on to whatever in the civilian world.
Okay. Well, John, let's take a break there for today.